I'm Hal Eisner, and this is What the Hal. And what we want to talk about is Los Angeles, Los Angeles County, and issues going on here that are relative to us, but may have implications elsewhere. Hilda Solis is a county supervisor, one of those on the county governing board, an elected official. Solis was in the Obama administration as Secretary of Labor, and a longtime politician before that as well. We sat down with Supervisor Solis, and we talked about a number of issues, and join us as we listen to that conversation. You know, I think there are a lot of things going on in this county that are really very interesting, and I think, you know, we have an opportunity here to have a conversation about some of these things and sort of get a status report even on what's going on in this county. And I think, first of all, we've had this really complicated situation over in the Vernon area that's kind of spread around East LA and several different communities involving the Exide battery plant, which no longer exists. It's shuttered.
Right.
But the thing is that what was there got into the soil.
Into the air.
Into
people that live there. People have been impacted. You see health impacts. I've seen people that have experienced cancer. In one block that I walked a year ago, there were 8 families that were impacted with cancer. How do you explain that? I mean, the science is there. We ought to be doing a better job of letting people know when they're exposed, at what levels, and to have people tested. That has been one of the biggest hardships for us, is to let people know that they should be tested for lead poisoning.
The county will do that free.
The
thing I don't understand, though, is when you have a cancer cluster, usually things get attacked right away.
Right.
Not here.
Well, I feel like there's been real neglect here, and I can show you differences where we had the big incident in Aliso Canyon, and you saw an immediate response there. Everyone, the governor, everybody was on board wanting to talk about it and get something done. You had people who had high-priced lawyers. In this case, you don't have that. You have a medium-income population there, blue-collar, Latino, immigrant. Maybe their average earnings annually is anywhere from $24,000 and less.
So you see
some extreme poverty, and you see what I would call an environmental injustice.
Injustice. Now, you're talking about everybody not being
treated
on an equal playing field.
Exactly. And that's a whole concept of environmental justice, where people happen to live in an area that has maybe several factories, heavy levels of pollution. They live next to three major freeways. Housing stock isn't the greatest. The water may not even be good. A lot of different impacts there over the years. And no one has really done much to help improve their lot.
So the sort of nagging question is, what's going to happen?
Well, the state is responsible. There's a toxic and substance control department that oversees the cleanup. They have been slow in moving. Almost 2 years ago, they shut down the plant that had been operating under an illegal permit for 33 years. And when you spew lead into the soil, it stays there. It does impact your health, and especially pregnant women and children that are under the age of 6. It can have very devastating impacts, neurologically. Tumors. I saw and met a young man who was 27 years old, but if you saw him, Hal, and he sat next to you, you would think he was 14 years old. His spine was disfigured. He had surgery because he had brain tumors. His body was deformed, and he lived a couple of blocks over from the battery recycling plant. And nobody can tell me or his parents that he was not exposed to something that was very, very dangerous and toxic.
Has it been scientifically connected? Have doctors said it is because of this?
Well, we know scientifically and medically speaking, when you are exposed to those levels, very high levels, some households had levels of 1,000 parts per million. The standard right now is about 300 parts per million for a facility. So if you're living in a house and you have 1,000, what does that tell you? The state says that the requirement should be 80. And the state is trying to bring, you know, trying to work at cleaning up these houses that are at 1,000 to get down to 80. But nothing has really been done. They've only cleaned up about less than 251 houses out of 2,500 that they originally earmarked. There are 10,000, though, I would say to you, that have really been impacted and need to be tested. They need to be cleaned on the exterior, the outside, the front yard, and the parkway, and the interior of the home. Right now, we're not there.
This is going on a long time.
It's been going on for several years. It has been shuttered. Their Exide is in bankruptcy court right now. There is Department of Justice intervention. EPA is involved. The state's involved. But slow moving. And the fact of the matter is you've got families that are saying, what about me? What is happening here? I have young children I'm caring for. I have a garden in the backyard. I raise my own tomatoes and vegetables. Are you telling me I should not eat those?
Well, we're saying, yes,
you should not eat those.
But on top of
vegetables.
That, their properties have dropped in value, right? Well, so it's hard to move and sell your house.
Right. You're saddled. You're saddled.
Yeah, you're saddled. And so the state had a plan to have a contractor do this, and that fell apart. What happened?
I think they didn't do a due diligence in really finding a contractor that understood how to work with the community and really understood what the science was behind it. I think the county has laid out a plan for the state to follow. We've asked for many things to clean the interior, the exterior, and the parkways, and not to do it in a hopscotch manner, but to do it block by block. The state refuses. They don't want to do it. They don't want to spend the money. And get this, of the $176 million that was approved 2 years ago, about $40 million has been expended. The remainder was not reauthorized this year. And that tells you something about who's watching out for the community and for this department.
But, you know, this is one of those, I'm not making light of it, but this is sort of one of those what the hell situations. I mean, how do you get this fixed and how do you do it quickly before other people are affected by that?
Well, we are trying through our efforts with the county and with the community to go up to Sacramento. We just were there a month ago and testified before a joint committee that actually oversees DTSC, the department that's supposed to be overseeing and monitoring the cleanup. We got the attention of some of the lawmakers, and we're hoping that we can have the remainder of the money put in the budget this coming week that the governor will release. We believe that the governor will work with us on that. But the fact still remains about the cleanup plan and how quickly they can get that done and how far will it go. We know that the money may not be enough, so we're going to look at other resources. We're going to look at other bills that have been passed that actually charge a fee on any batteries. That money can then be used to help perhaps the cleanup. Some people want to use it to pay back this loan, the $176 million. I say we need to take care of people's lives.
People first.
People first, always.
There's not just one big issue that you deal with. Immigration's another big issue.
Yes, it is, because we do have in the county of Los Angeles over 3 million people who are immigrants and about 1 million that we know of that are undocumented. And that means kids that maybe were not born here, or maybe their parents were, or vice versa. You have mixed families. So when the Trump administration comes in and says, we want to deport everyone, can you imagine what impact that has on a child that goes to school and says to his teacher or to his mom, I don't want to wake up because I'm afraid if I come home, no one's going to come here. I'm not going to come home to an empty home. Or if I go to school and I come home, mommy and dad isn't going to be home. What's going to happen to me? We've heard these stories from teachers, from parents, and from students. And it's real.
We had a guest on here named Anila Ali, who's got an organization she started in Orange County. It's a Muslim women's organization. But years ago, I met her years ago when she wrote a book. And the book was called Mommy MIA, and the line was left blank with a question mark, but in her mind it was Mommy Am I a Terrorist? Because the child would hear about Muslims and hear about terrorists, and
well,
people would talk to them in school.
Yeah, that's what Trump said about Mexicans. I happen to be Mexican-American and Central American. My mother's was from Nicaragua, but I was born here. When you hear Trump talking about Mexicans as rapists, as drug dealers, as people who belong to gangs, it's almost he's as though he's painting all of us with one stroke, one brush, saying you're all bad people. And that is how people have felt. When the election took place, what is it, more than a year, almost whatever, right after that happened in my community, that one of the communities that I represent in Azusa, there was a woman, Mexican woman with a child. She was pushing in a stroller. There was a guy, a gray-haired guy in a red truck, drives by and throws a bottle of beer at her and says, get out of here, wetback, and take your you-know-what with you. And that's a hate crime. And that was reported. Our sheriffs investigated it. And we started to see more of that happen, not just to Mexicans, but to Muslims, to anybody who looked different. Anybody who looked different. And we said at the county board of supervisors, no. People have rights, and we ought to be there protecting their rights, and they ought to know that this is not acceptable and to report it.
There are numbers out there that show a rise in hate crimes.
Absolutely.
A rise in tension, a rise in... You know, we're just so split in this country.
Xenophobic, gender, everything.
Yeah.
Everything.
Well, what do we do about that?
I think we have to talk about civility, and we have to talk about laws, how they protect people. We do have civil rights here. We do try to run according to what our, you know, rule of law is. We know that public safety, law enforcement should be there to protect us, even if you are an immigrant. And if you scare the you-know-what out of immigrants, they're not going to report crime. You're going to see more crime, and that's, in fact, what's happening. You see people right now that are U.S. citizens and legal residents that are eligible for services from the county. They can have their children sign up for nutritional programs. They're refusing to because they think any bit of information that they give to anybody, especially a governmental institution, that it will be shared with immigration. And lo and behold, someone's going to go out and snatch them.
There are people that say you got to start with the kids, that's where you got to start. And you know, the philosophy that you're born pure, but you learn to hate. Mm-hmm. And so you start with kids to keep them from learning to hate. Interviewed a woman named Esther Leon Schwartz. This is a woman who, when she was 4 years old with her parents, were running from the Nazis in 1942, 41, along in there. And that's when the war started. So about 43, 44. And her dad threw her over a fence so a soldier in Switzerland could catch her in neutral territory. Dad went over, got shot, but he survived. He pulled mom over, and that was terror. Later in life, when she was a grandmother, her son, her grandson, was, as I mentioned to you before the show, a victim of the JCC, the Jewish Community Center in Granada Hills, shooting, and that involved several injuries and a death. Right. And he escaped from that. And then years later in Parkland, Florida, her granddaughter escaped from that high school, a family that's dealt with hate all their lives.
Right.
And she says, and I think this is a novel idea, I don't know how effective it would be, that what we ought to be doing is taking kids at a young age in school after the Pledge of Allegiance, have them get into a buddy circle, and everybody talk about what they're grateful about. Do it every day, and she thinks eventually kids will learn to like each other.
Reinforce good behavior and positiveness and openness and accepting diversity and different voices and different values and different religions. I mean, I think that was the whole premise of how our country got started. You know, give me your tired, your poor. In Ellis Island, New York. I mean, we are a country of immigrants, regardless of what people think. And most undocumented people that are here in this country have not all come from Mexico or Central or Latin America. They are people who have overstayed their visas. They came as tourists. They came as students. They came as workers. They come from Canada, from Germany, from Europe, from South Africa, from many other parts of the world. And for one individual in the White House to single out Mexicans in that manner and assume that we're all terrorists and we're bad people and all we do is take from the government without knowing his facts, that we actually provide jobs, we actually add to the GDP, we actually grow things and prosper. We're entrepreneurs, we're teachers, we're scientists, and lo and behold, some of us can even be daughters of immigrants to become Secretary of Labor.
And let's go there, because you were Secretary of Labor under the Obama administration, and I talked to you back then, and you had a lot of programs going on, very, very active department, and so you look at the Department of Labor now, and let's talk about then versus now.
Well, it's very disappointing. Many of the programs that we put in place, regulations to provide safety and protection for workers. One incident that just really blew my mind was Blankenship, the guy that ran in West Virginia, was put away for 1 year because he ran an illegal mine. 29 miners died. That was under our watch. We had to use every tool in our toolbox to prosecute him, put him away for illegally running that coal mine. And then he has the audacity, after he gets out of prison, to run to be a U.S. senator. I can't believe what I see going on in our country. He did not care about those workers that worked for him in that coal mine. I happen to have met families there as Labor Secretary was out there. I met with the 29 families, and I had learned so much. They had softened my heart and moved me in a way that I said, we are going to use everything we can to go after that man and shut down any coal mines that are not abiding by the safety and protection that are set in place by our Cal OSHA laws and our regulations. And it was just just an experience that I will never forget. And I can't believe that we're going back to that.
Well, you know, a lot of people will say that this administration kind of wants to wipe out the work of the past administration. Do you feel that way?
Yes. He wants to get rid of Obamacare, the ACA. He wants to get rid of civil rights protections. He wants to also add a question on the census application, if you're a citizen or not. That has no place on that application. We fought that war back in the 1950s. So he wants to take us back before the civil rights was even approved in 1964.
Is he ruining or trying to ruin or take away or take apart any of your programs?
I would say that yes, he has. I mean, he's trying to cut back on many programs that provide protections for worker safety and inspections. That's where it is. The bottom line is also when you take away the enforcement tools, that is your investigators to go out and prosecute, that takes away a whole lot of things for people, good people who are working out in the fields or working in factories, even places like Exide, where you have to have more safety and protection for your workers. Because if not, you're going to be held liable or you will kill people. And we don't want to. Our whole theory was you prevent these kinds of tragedies. You keep people from dying on construction sites because someone didn't appropriately get the training for how to apply tools, equipment, ladders, things of that nature.
Public officials, those are our leaders. You're our leaders. And it's your job to provide us security and safety and make sure we have the kinds of services that we need with our tax dollars.
To the extent that we can. The county government is very different. We actually get, we have the responsibility to as a mandate to provide the safety net. So when federal government fails or state fails, then it gets thrown onto the county, so to speak. And if we don't get sufficient funding from the federal government, then we're not going to be able to uphold any of our responsibilities. And I see that happening right now.
Let's talk about that safety net. Homelessness.
Yes, that's one of them. If you have less vouchers to put people in motels and hotels because they live out on the street, how does that impact our society? What about hepatitis A? What about all these things that happen when you're living out on the street like that? It is impacting us now. And we just had the Secretary of HUD come out and visit with some of our board members. And he said, you know what? I'm going to institute a new rule that says you're going to have to work 20 hours if you receive Section 8 housing or any kind of assistance. Well, let me tell you what that might look like for people who live in a housing project in East LA. You may have a mother who has 3 or 4 kids. If she's forced to work 20 hours, she's going to now have to pay for child care because she won't get it free from anyone there. And if she works, she may only get minimum wage and maybe only part-time because maybe she only has a high school education. So what is she going to end up doing? She's going to probably say, how am I going to do this? I'm not going to be able to meet any of this criteria and not even be able to bring home enough funds to cover meals for my children.
Dealing with the general growing problem of homelessness, LA is trying to cope with this, but when we talk to city council members, they say, well, we now have a coordinated effort with the county and with
the state,
with the federal government. Can you explain that, how
well,
that works?
Well, the county actually and the city are working together. They passed Prop HHH. That's to help build out housing, transitional housing. That's the brick and mortar. Our initiative that also passed was going to provide wraparound services, the mental health services, the detox, the transitional housing, whatever assistance that's needed immediately, mental health, all of the other things that have to be done, job training, things of that nature. If we come together, we're able to spread that safety net and actually able to help improve the lives of many more people. We are doing that now. We're looking at coordinating where we can look at our own properties that the city and the county has and say, let's maybe repurpose that old building there and structure it so it could be a recuperative care facility for people that were on the street or for transitional housing for young people, just like the woman that you interviewed earlier, foster care. Many of those young foster care kids turn out to be homeless if there's no safety net for them after they are thrown out of foster care at the age of 18.
The city is going to put in each city council district a shelter. It's an emergency shelter,
yeah.
And it's transitional. Mm-hmm. It's a bridge to housing, right. Basically, is what they're referring to it as. Okay, those are good efforts. But, you know, you can't get people to do something they don't want to do. And when I've talked to people on the street before, and I've done many homeless stories in the past, a lot of people just don't want to go. They are fine where they are. Leave me alone.
Many
I want
of them
nothing
have,
to do with that.
Many of them have, there's a high proportion that have mental illness. Many do have substance abuse, whether it's alcoholism or drug abuse. Methamphetamine is one of those drugs that you can get very easily. We need to have many forces working with us, including the legislature. I think the county is working on legislation now up in Sacramento to look at how we can tighten up some rules to help people that aren't even, that can't even make a decision about taking medicine. And when they can't make a decision, they're hurting themselves, but they also could be hurting someone else. So we're having a review of that. And we have to be very careful because we don't want to somehow usurp person's civil rights, right? Because we don't want to go back to the days of Ronald Reagan when a lot of that stuff was going on. You put people away and carelessly just, you know, let them rot. We don't want that to happen. We want to set a better example. But we also have to have more facilities and we have to have more cities beyond the city of L.A. And just the government of the county. We have to have cities. We have 88 cities. They also have to say, guess what? Me too. I need to help. I need to step up. I need to help work with maybe my neighboring city and see how we can pull our funds together to create a shelter, to create a better way of life for people.
There's violence. There's violence. We saw in Ventura not that long ago where a man was killed by a homeless person, allegedly, but that person died. It's being blamed on somebody who was homeless. There's violence, and much
but
of
not
that
all,
is probably
but,
because
right,
of mental illness.
Right. Yeah. And those types of individuals shouldn't be on the street. If you know they are serious, violent, they should be put in an appropriate place, okay? And not even in our jails, because you're putting a lot of people in jail who are mentally ill, homeless, and they're not sufficiently capable of doing all of that. It's very expensive proposition to do that. I'd rather see facilities outside of a jail that can provide wraparound services, mental health, and stabilize that person if it has to be from 2 years or more. But we need to do something. And I believe people are open to that.
Let me, I want to ask you about one pilot project I heard about, and I want to see what you think about it. And that's an idea where a company is proposing putting little small houses
right
in backyards.
Mm-hmm. Granny homes, granny flats.
Right. Like a guest house.
Yeah.
But the thing is, we hear about NIMBY, right? Not in my backyard. Mm-hmm. And now we're talking about putting it right in your backyard.
Well, not necessarily. The county is going to be looking at how we do that in unincorporated areas. And there are many of those granny flats that exist now. Many people have illegally converted their garages to, say, an apartment or an extra room. What we need to do is help them legally convert that room so that it is, you know, abiding by all our codes and what have you. So there isn't fire, there isn't all this other damage that could occur because it wasn't done correctly to begin with. But if we help people, incentivize them, and give them opportunity that if they take in, say, homeless people, and the homeless person does want to get help, then we could provide wraparound services and even help pay for part of that rent. That's a new proposition to look
is.
At.
It is. It's a serious issue. It needs some very serious attention. I know it's getting it on the county, the city level, but it seems overwhelming. It just seems overwhelming.
Well, it is, and I feel very privileged that at this time I'm in a position where I can try to come up with new ideas of how to address this. Take, for example, in my district, we have people that live in the San Gabriel Riverbed. in LA River. We have people living there. We found out that there were about 150 encampments next to Whittier Narrows Park. 150. Multiply that by two or three people that live in one encampment. You're talking about a whole community out there. So one of the ideas that I had after talking with people is to get a mobile shower, a unit out in our parking lot at Whittier Narrows so that people could come out of their encampments, at least get a meal, talk to some social workers, talk to folks from the county, and then take a shower and get some clothing, get a haircut, and maybe get to talk to someone about how they could maybe transition out of that encampment. We are doing this. It's on a pilot effort right now. We started out, I think, with 30 people showing up the first day. Now we're up to about 90. We're almost up at capacity. And I think this is a new way of just thinking about how we treat people humanely. Okay, I'm not saying it's going to solve everything, but we've got to do something.
So we get back to how we treat people, whether it's a political divide, whether it's racism or hate or bigotry, or whether it's how we deal with the homeless. It's really all about how we take personal responsibility for helping our fellow man or woman.
And respect and dignity. I think most people, even homeless people, want to be respected. They want to know that people are not going to just put them down and be patronizing, but to understand them in some way and maybe help give them some tools and maybe talk to them. When was the last time you walked by a homeless person and you didn't even look at them because you just felt, wow, I can't deal with this. I don't even want to acknowledge that person.
But part of that is fear, right? Part of that is fear. What's that
anxiety,
person going to do to me?
Anxiety, but
right.
Maybe they're not going to do anything
no,
to
they,
you.
No, some of them are very nice. I've talked to people who are very nice.
There you go.
Yeah.
And what about kids that are homeless, that live in a car with a parent, a single mom? She works but doesn't have enough money to pay the first and last and has three kids in her car. What do you say about that? Are we afraid to talk about that? Are we afraid to help that family?
What do we do for the people that are on the exit ramps and the entry ramps and along the sidewalks and they've got their signs? What do we do about that? I mean, that is a keeping the problem going by not providing something in the area where the people are residing.
Well, we need to have teams, and we do have teams available. We need to have more, though. And we get funding through LASA to help them. That's the homeless group that goes out there, and they're like a team. And
Los Angeles actually, Housing
Authority,
Authority.
And they actually help people understand, that there are reasonable ways of addressing this. And many were formerly homeless, too, so they have a way of helping to persuade and talk to these individuals.
I want to give you a softball. Can you believe I'm saying that? I want to give you a softball. What is the most important thing that you would like to do that is not dealing with the kinds of subjects we've just been talking about?
I think I would like to see more funding for the arts for children. We just had a performance at the Board of Supervisors with, I think it was about six children out of Huntington Park. They're the only mariachi group in the whole area of all those eight cities, the only one that has been able to get awards because they have an after-school program that the teacher helps to fund and goes to the community to raise money just so the kids can have a mariachi, beautiful costumes and their instruments. And these kids are talented. There was the age group starting at 8 years old, a young girl whose guitar was bigger than she was, and two little boys that were playing the trumpet. The trumpet was bigger than half of the size of their body, but they played beautifully. I would encourage people to go online last week's meeting and to look it up. It's amazing. And if we could give every kid an opportunity to enjoy art, science, math, all of that, I think we would be in a better world.
I did a story on them last year, and they were very impressive. And I think you're right. I mean, I think that we've lost a lot of the arts education.
We have. It's been cut out.
And it's after-school programs that's trying to pick up the slack.
And also having funding for our parks. So kids, after 3 o'clock, you're told to go home because no one could keep the gate open at the school, so you got to go home. But there's nowhere to play. We are park poor in some of our communities. We need to have our parks open, and they need to have recreation. They need to have computer labs. They need to have art programs. They need to have study sessions. And they need to be open all during the summer and even in the winter, because where are these kids going to go? They're going to create problems if we don't have some good substantive things for them to do.
It's about our kids.
Families.
Just like Esther Leone talked about. It's about our kids, making them better citizens from the very beginning.
Right, right. Just as you said.
Supervisor Solis, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All right. And to all of you, thanks for subscribing to our podcast. Oh, you haven't yet? Well, all you have to do is go to iTunes or Google Play or any of the podcast platforms and just sign up and subscribe, and then you'll get a notification every week. Also, leave a little feedback, hopefully, if you like it. Anyway, thanks for joining us. See you next time.